What an auspicious beginning. So, this is it, the third and final Aikman in our series.
It is, and it is also the second to last story.
The second to last story, and our last story, we're not going to get into it yet, because we're going to be talking about that next week. But but this story kind of feels like a real final story.
This story feels like my life.
Oh, being forced into awkward social situations that you do not care for, and then ending up on a hearse being driven into the countryside.
Yeah.
Being bit by a cat? Maybe, I don't know.
I think it was a person.
It would have been a small, in any case, we'll talk about that. But first of all, I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro time.
It's Del Toro time.
Yes.
I should say, if you guys hear any weird noise in the background, it's because there's a man in my house drilling in our basement.
Is it the driller killer?
No, it's the same person who did our bathroom upstairs.
If we can hear the drilling in the basement through your microphone, I'm just going to be like, we deserve it because you have the best microphone.
So loud.
I can't hear a darn thing. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you hear drilling, it's probably because I added it later on.
Awesome. Okay, cool.
So this is the penultimate story of The Dark Descent, the fabulous formless darkness, the section of which is all about something weird's going on, but we never really find out what. And I would say that this week's story, The Hospice by Robert Aikman, is a great example of that.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
A story that's very much like, I found it to be very much like Crouch End by Stephen King. The one with the couple that ends up in the weird part of town and they barely escape, but there's really no explanation as to what was going on in Crouch End.
Yeah,
this is the story of a man who ends up in a bad place, a lot of weird things happen with no explanation, and he maybe gets away. The end.
I think he gets away.
Maybe. Trust me, there's so many discussions out there.
I also think this man has autism.
Oh, well, there's a new one. You think he has autism? Well, I guess, okay, well, we'll talk about that.
He's neurodivergent in some way, shape, or form.
Some way, shape, or form, which Robert Aikman very well may have been in his real life. There's a great 1-hour-long documentary that was made, that came out, called Robert Aikman, author of Strange Tales by R.B. Russell and Rosalie Parker, who are they both are experts on weird fiction. They run I think they run Tartarus Press together, and they put together this 1-hour doc about Aikman, featuring a lot of interviews with people who were friends with him, people who knew him.
Yeah.
And it's just about his writing and about like what makes an Aikman story an Aikman story, what made Aikman Aikman. It's on YouTube. I highly recommend people go check it out. Robert Aikman, teller of strange tales or author of strange tales. And it's on R.B. Russell's YouTube page. But it's very telling that he was trying to write throughout his entire life a type of story that is like the pure weird, which is, or he didn't call it weird. He called them strange tales. He's like, ghost stories too limiting, horrors too limiting. He's like, these are strange tales just because they're strange and there's no explanation and they're not there to make you feel comfortable at the end. They're just there to happen. And having read more about him and having read more Robert Aikman, I have Cold Hand in Mind back here, a great collection of short stories. I have Compulsory Games, another collection of Robert Aikman stories. I'll say that The Swords, which was the second one we read, doesn't make any more sense to me, but it makes more sense in the body of his, I get it more, what he's going for.
I felt that after reading this one.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because the first Aikman story we read was Larger Than Oneself.
Which was bizarre, right? That was bizarre.
It was the one about a guy who ends up going to a place where he's not comfortable, surrounded by a lot of eccentrics, except that one had a definite ending. Like it was like, oh, this thing came out of the sky and it like burned everybody to a crisp, except like our protagonist and a couple other people. And you sort of got an explanation. A lot of Robert Aikman critics and literary writers talk about this story, The Hospice, which was written near the end of his life. I think it's like 4 or 5 years before he died. Near the end of his life, they talk about this one as kind of being a perfection of what he was going for with Larger Than Oneself, where he just cut away all the excess and is like, you don't get an explanation at the end. There's no comfort for our protagonist. It's just a nightmare, and then you stop reading.
Yep.
So this story, the hospice, which I forgot to pull up. So hold on. The hospice is from 1975. It first appeared in Cold Hand in Mine, in 1975. And then it appeared the next year in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. And it also is in The Weird, the large collection by Jeff and Ann Vandermeer.
Is that the one that had Sand Kings in it?
It's the one that has Sand Kings in it. So it's floated around. It was in the collection of Tartarus Press. It's just it's always going to be in collections of ghost stories and supernatural stories.
I think Sand Kings as a story has had the most impact on me out of any other like short horror story.
Why?
I don't know. It's just the one that's always stuck with me.
It's
just like
weird one.
It's just in my head all the time. I remember you reading it to me.
Uh-huh.
Like I remember it clearly. And then sometimes it just comes into my head and I'm always like, oh yeah, Sand Kings.
I believe that if we ever get to David G. Hartwell's next collection, his collection of novellas, I believe Sand Kings is in one of those.
Yeah.
So if we're still doing this in 10 years, maybe we'll get to Sand Kings. So this is considered a novella or a novelette. But before we get started on what it's about, why don't you tell us what David G. Hartwell likes about it? Why don't you out that book? Why don't you open up the book like I always ask you to do in every episode?
No, you don't.
Always.
What? You never asked me to open the book.
Open the book, Willow.
Well, just right off the bat, this is the third Aickman story we've had, and I think that's more than any other author. So I think our boy David G. Hartwell is a little bit of a fan of our boy Aickman.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about, he opens up his, like, talking about Robert Aickman, this story, with just a general statement about Robert Aickman's story that we've already said a few times, which is, you always maintain a certain level of doubt as to the nature of what is literally going on.
Yes.
He calls this one a classic Aickman.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have said that.
Yeah. A paradigm of our third variety of horror, wherein the moral structures are deconstructed, as in Jackson's The Summer People, and the psychological conceits unreliable. All details and every effect contribute to profound and unsettling instability, suggestive of undefinable horror, which is most certainly there.
It literally is, and I know we've said this about several of these stories, but it literally is the story of, I have extreme social anxiety, this is the worst case scenario.
It's like, not even just extreme social anxiety, because our main character opens with being like, I like sticking to the path that the car people gave me, and any deviation from that is bad and I hate it, and I'm only doing this because a man literally watched me to make sure I did.
Right. So yeah, so our hero, if you want to call him that, what is his name?
Mayberry.
He is not the most, he's not a hero. Yeah, he's nobody's hero. But he is, he's what, a salesman? A traveling salesman?
Something like that.
And he is going on a work trip, but
I thought he was going home. I'm pretty sure he was driving home from his work office.
Well, then why was he so he's given a route that is not...
I don't know. I was really confused because he seems pretty intent that he's going home because he wants to call his wife because his wife is expecting him.
Well, he is, but he is somewhere that he has not been before.
I think he just got lost on the quote shortcut.
I believe what happened was he had gone somewhere for work.
Okay.
And the person, the site manager at that place was like, no, 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 no. If you want to get back to where you were, here's the route you want to take.
That would make sense.
And it's in the exact opposite direction of where he thinks he needs to be driving in the first place.
Yeah.
But as you said, the guy stands there and makes sure he heads off in the direction he told him.
Which is so upsetting.
Yes.
I think the opening part of this story upset me more than anything that happened afterwards.
Because he has his, like, he has his power to make decisions taken away from
him. Yeah, but also, like, if I was doing something like this and somebody was like, no, here's a shortcut. I'm going to stand here to make sure you take it. I would watch their face in my, like, rearview mirror as I went the way that I wanted to go.
Right, what are they going to do? But I think that speaks to, and a lot of this story deals with, this sort of old-fashioned, I mean, it's set in the 1970s. It's set in the modern time.
And
but
I think
this old-fashioned, like, British, like, gentility, you don't want to rock the boat, so you're not going to even stand up for yourself.
I think this like that sort of the really super strict adherence he has to like rules and routes and trying to like follow everything to the letter is what made me be like neurodivergent.
Oh, I see what you're. Yes, definitely. Yeah. I can totally see that. Like in a way, this is almost like a inside look at a person's head. Like here's what the world seems like to someone whose brain is neurodivergent, and they don't like. Whereas everyone else like, seems to be going along with all this, just the none of the rules make sense.
Yeah, it was I went to Target with my mom and we had to go to the pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to pick up a headphone like connector thing, and my mom's like, oh, we can just buy that at the pharmacy. And I was like, no, that doesn't make any sense. That's it's the pharmacy, you can't buy things at the pharmacy. And my mom spent like 10 minutes trying to explain to me that it was okay, and I just didn't get it.
Yeah, little things like that. And that's what this entire story is so he gets lost, obviously, and he ends up in a weird neighborhood that he's never been in before. And he starts running low on gas and he passes a sign for a hospice, which in America generally means a place a person goes or a situation a person is in when they are near death.
Yep.
And they're just being kept comfortable until death. But can also mean what I think we refer to as a hostel, like a place for a person to go to just sort of stay overnight. That's not a hotel.
Yeah.
And that's, I believe, intentional on Aikman's part. Like, is this a hospice or is this a hospice? No answers.
He does get bit by a creature before he finds this place.
Yep. He thinks there's a cat. It darts out of the bushes and bites him, but it's dark and he can't see. And then it's gone. And that leads him to head to the hospice because it seems to have, like, taken a pretty good bite out of him.
Yeah. He kicked at it and there was no like sound or impact. There was no like animal cry out. It was just gone.
Yeah.
And he thought he saw two glowing eyes maybe, but he's not sure.
This is the point where I was like flashing back to our years ago when we were obsessed with redefining stories as fey tales.
Yeah.
Because this story can also be read as someone's encounter with the fae, like accidentally crossing over into their realm lot of ways.
He literally walked into their realm, was confronted by a bunch of rules he didn't understand, was forced to eat a bunch of food, and they're really trying to get him to stay after he ate all of that food.
Yep. And it's like human beings acting as if they're not really people. They're just acting
they're,
like people.
They're strangely beautiful in some cases and strangely like...
Their appearances change.
Yeah.
Also, there's weird sex stuff going on.
Oh,
maybe murder and a guy shackled to a dining room table.
Yep.
So he goes to the hostel and he's let in and they're like, oh, dinner's already started. He gets seated at this table and is served like gross food, but not like
it's not even gross food. It's just a lot of really rich food, which is gross in my opinion.
Yeah. And that's what I liked. It's not that it's bizarre food. It's probably decent enough food if you're just at like a cheap like diner. And also, it's like a giant plate of soup.
Yeah.
And it's like just slightly the wrong temperature. It's just a little too thick.
And it's incredibly hot in the dining room.
Yes. And they keep alluding to the fact that like it's what, like chicken night, a turkey? It's turkey night.
Turkey night, yeah.
It's turkey night. And he's like, okay, like, and they just
And keep talking to him like he's like a toddler.
Yeah, yeah. Like there's this real infantilizing sense that, and this whole time he doesn't ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
He's so just like, I'm British and I'm just going to go along with it. Don't rock the boat. Don't embarrass anyone. They'll just go along with this. And to the point where he gets full and he refuses some of the food that the waitress offers him and she smashes the plate on the floor.
Yeah. And he's like, that's it. That's enough now.
But it's not enough.
No. He gets to leave the dining room, thankfully.
Yeah. So there is this sense that he's not trapped there.
Yeah.
He's allowed to go if he wants, but things conspire to keep him there.
It's that sense of like, oh yeah, somebody's telling you you're allowed to do something, but you know if you do. Like there's that sense of if you do this thing, you are doing something wrong.
You're doing something wrong. Everyone will know. Mm-hmm. So there's Mr. Faulkner, who's who's the staff, a staff person at the hospice, who's kind of like his guide.
And who somehow knows his name.
Who somehow knows his name. But like so many things in the story, there's kind of an explanation. He left
a really weird explanation.
He left a file on like the front seat of his car and it had his name on it. He's like, so the guy could have gone to my car and seen the name. I don't know why he would, but everything here is kind of weird. There's also a woman named Cecile.
And there's a young man named Nathan?
Nathaniel? Vincent.
Vincent. Where's Nathaniel coming from?
I don't know. there's Vincent. And you start getting this sense that, like, Cecile's been there a long time.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be trying to seduce Maybury at
but
one
also,
point.
But also, like, seems to be implying something with Vincent.
But between... also that, like, Vincent's parts don't work.
Yeah.
Properly, this young man, she, like, sexually humiliates him in front of Maybury.
Yeah.
But also, Maybury's married. He has a wife, Angela, and a son named Tony, who he's trying
who
to
he
get
cares
home
about.
To.
Yeah, he wants to call them, but there's no... We learn later there's no phone.
Right, because it's set up as like, no, this is a place people come when they want to get away from the distractions of life. Like, if this was a modern tale, like, they'd probably take his cell phone away. Which, again, that's a thing. Like,
yeah.
There's no phone here because they don't want the phone ringing all the time. So, okay, it's kept warm here because these are older people and they need the place kept warm.
Except for they're not all older people.
They're not all older people.
Supposedly.
So Cecile is, like, she's also... in that weird, like, she's attractive but she's unsettling. He's attracted to her, but only because, like, it's kind of flattering that she's into him. But
she doesn't watch television,
which makes her the worst.
No, it's just, I think it adds to the, because she doesn't seem to recognize, like, a famous person's name from modern, like, time.
Which is also an indication that this is a place out of time. Like,
and
these
also
people,
that maybe she's older than she appears to be.
Or have these people been trapped here for, like, 100 years, or, like, 20 years, 30 years. We don't know, because, again, no explanations
offered. She also seems really depressed.
Yes.
And she seems really worried about not fitting into this place.
Right. Again, we see a man at one point in the kitchen or in the dining room with his leg shackled to a rail.
Yeah.
And it's never brought up again. He just notices it and he's like, okay, like, that's weird. He tries to go home at one point. He tries to get in the car and go, but he can't start the car, not because it's broken down, but because he just can't remember how to make it go.
Yeah.
He's like, it's not broken. It's not, there's nothing wrong with the car. It's just, I can't quite.
Hey, I've been there before when I'm overwhelmed and overstimulated.
Yes. But also, if it's a supernatural thing and he's like, it's that dream thing where you can't read in a dream, like, just things don't make sense. But again, it's that thing where, like, it's not falling into cliches. No one's keeping him there. They get, like, the handyman at one point. What's the handyman's name? Cromie?
Cromie.
This, like, sort of brutish handyman to come out and be like, car's broken. Like, that's it. Like, just, like, can't do it. So let's talk about Mr. Bernard.
That was a character. He, after the car doesn't work, Mr. Faulkner comes, I'll comp you for the night, and for dinner and stuff. And he's like, okay, I guess I would really rather not deal with this. Can I call my wife? And Mr. Faulkner's like, no.
Yeah.
No phones. Also, nothing, within 20 miles of here is open. So good luck.
Yeah.
He's like, great, I guess I'll stay then. And then Mr. Faulkner's like, oh, but also, we don't have any single rooms here. You have to sleep with, like, you have to sleep in a room with someone. So I'll have Mr. Bernard come down. He's great.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's fine.
He's not unsettling at all.
No, he's the best. He's the best. And this man comes down and he has, like thin red hair.
Yeah.
And, like, green eyes. He's not, like, ancient.
Yeah.
He seems to be a youngish man. Like, 30s, I think is what we said.
Yeah, he's just, it's hard to place his age. He's not the healthiest looking guy in the world. He's thin, tired looking.
Yeah.
But he's friendly.
At first.
Right.
And so they go up to the room. And while they're walking up, Bernard is, like, explaining, like, all of the rules. I guess. Mm-hmm, like,
kind of.
You have to be really quiet because if you wake someone up, that's really bad. And there are a lot of light sleepers here. And he's like, okay, I guess. Fine. Whatever. I just want to go to bed. And they get into the room and Bernard is weird towards him. He's like, go ahead and get changed into the pajamas.
Yeah, there's
pajamas.
Just like pajamas.
Staring directly at him.
Yeah.
And he suggests doing something at some point.
So there's a weird, like, undercurrent of sexuality in this story.
Just like in Swords. Except for that wasn't an undercurrent. That was just an overt current.
an overcurrent.
Yeah.
This one is like, it doesn't focus on sex, but it's kind of like, it's very much like, if you're dealing with this sort of like, the hospice is very similar to like, it's decorated in Victorian style.
Yeah.
Which brings up its own like the repression of sexuality and sex. Yeah. There's this interaction with Cecile, who comes on to him, and like, I think he puts his hand on her breast.
She brings his hand to her breast.
Yeah.
Like, she forces his hand to her breast because she's like, touch the dress. And he's like,
And then
she, yeah.
Yeah. And Bernard is like, tell me about your wife and son. And at one point he like tries to get in.
Before that he says, like, we can do something.
Yeah. And that's like, there's this really weird. Yeah. It's this confrontation with male sexuality that may or may not be there. Like, again, it's up to you to read into it.
Yeah. And Bernard gets real weird about turning the lights off.
Yes, he does not want to turn out the lights.
And then there's this whole, like, war of politeness that happens where Mayberry's like, no, we don't have to, like, turn out the lights or whatever. And Bernard is like, no, if that's what you want, you're blah, 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 blah. And they eventually turn off the lights. And then
things go weird.
Things
go sideways a little bit. Yeah. Because Bernard gets up.
Yeah, and leaves.
Quietly.
Really quietly.
Like, and suspiciously quietly.
And Mayberry is like, oh, well, now I feel kind of bad for being so weird about this guy because he's clearly trying to make sure that he doesn't wake me up. And I'm like, dude, this is weird.
And then the screaming starts.
Out of everything that has happened, this is the one thing you're like, no, that seems normal.
Right. And then the screaming starts in the hotel. Which,
the inhuman screaming?
Yes. Which could, because of the interactions we've had with Cecile, could be screams of pleasure, could be screams of I'm being murdered. We don't know. Also, he can't open the door. Also, he tries
there's no windows.
There's no window. He tries to
it's
open
like
the
it's like that episode of Doctor Who where they get stuck in the Minotaur's maze.
Yeah.
And they pull the curtains open and it's just a wall.
It's just a wall. There's just a wall. He's like, okay, there's no way out. And the door is stuck in the same way there is no window. Like, it just seems like there's no door. Like, it's just not a, it's like a fake. But again, could be all in his head. Makes sense that there's no, that maybe they're in an interior room and it's just decorative curtains just to give you a sense of space. We don't know.
We have no idea.
Because Bernard comes back, but he
changed. Looks different. Yeah.
He's a different guy.
His hair is gray. He's older, I think. And he's just like, yo, what's up? I'm back.
Yeah.
And then that's when the conversation about his wife and kid happens, and it's weird and uncomfortable, and he's like, I'm just going to convince myself this was a dream, I think. That's my plan. I'm like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Been there. Done that. Can we just write this whole day off as a bad dream? Perfect.
Yep.
Unfortunately for our hero, Mayberry does not get to write off this evening because he wakes up the next morning and there's been a death in the hospice.
Yeah. He goes downstairs and people are like, have some breakfast. And he's like, no.
Yeah.
I want to go now. I'm going to walk, actually. I'm just going to walk back. I'm going to walk a couple of miles. I'm just going to go. And Mr. Faulkner's like, well, I have a plan.
Yeah.
See, somebody was killed last night. There's a hearse coming that you could catch a lift with.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess. Yeah, sure. I'll ride in the hearse.
They're like, they're bringing the body down. Don't call any attention to it. We don't want to upset the other guests.
Mm-hmm.
And then just sort of slip into the back of the hearse.
Yeah. And not only that, it seems like a lot of things have changed, like appearance-wise for most people. Like he doesn't, thinks of some of them as new guests. He can't see Cecile, which means she's either the dead one or she's changed her appearance like the other guy did.
Yep.
Like things are just slightly different now.
Yes. And this all happens very quickly. Like,
yeah. In like like a paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Coffin comes down the stairs. Vincent is with the people bringing it down. So we don't know anything about what happened with Vincent. He gets his evening and his food comped. Climbs in the back of the hearse. They get to a bus stop, and the Undertaker is like, "All right, you shouldn't have to wait long." That's the end of the story. And it's understandable that there's a lot of people who jump to the conclusion of, "Oh, he died. He's the one who died in the night." But that almost seems far too obvious. Like, yeah. I don't think Aikman died at all.
I think that somebody else died. I think it was Cecile personally, because she was not fitting in to the whole like situation. But it could have been anybody. It could have been Bernard, and whatever came into his room after that was something completely different.
I think the matter of who died is less important than how the manager reacts to it and uses that as a way to get Mabry out of the hospice.
Yeah.
Maybe
nobody died and it was just a ruse.
Right. You have to get out. You have to steal away in this coffin, like on this hearse with this coffin. Mm-hmm. But you'll get out. And I'm like, well, if he's helping Mabry out, why doesn't he let anybody else out? Is it because Mabry doesn't fit in? Is it because it's still early enough that Mabry can leave? Is it just that Mabry was a guy who stumbled into this weird hospice and they're like, this guy doesn't have a reservation, so we're just going to get him out of here? Like,
Faulkner, I think, can be read as both a villain and like not a villain, because he seems to be genuinely trying to assist Mabry in leaving the right. whole time. Like, it's not like he's the one who is like stopping Mabry.
Yes.
He does everything that he can to get Mabry out of the hospice. It's just that something else is keeping Mabry there.
Right. Yeah, I don't know.
No, I think, here's my theory, Willow's theory. I think that the people in the hospice are all the same people that they were the night before. I think that there's something weird going on with the whole, like, nature thing that happened. Because we didn't mention that. Bernard says, oh, yeah, we like, do as, like, as nature, like, how do you eat so much? Oh, it's what nature does, what she does. We, like, how does he put it exactly? Something about giving nature her head or whatever.
Okay.
So I think there's some weird, not necessarily cult thing going on, but I think there's some weird other force happening in this place. And
we simply let nature have its way.
Yeah.
Or rather, her way. We give nature her head.
Yeah. I think that somehow the like residents of this hospice go back and forth, like switch off being youthful and being old. Like, I think that there's like an exchange going on of some kind, either with each other or with something else. And they each get their like evening or whatever of being young and pretty, and like sexual, and it like goes between all of them.
That's a good theory.
Yeah. And that's why, yeah, I don't know. The food thing was weird. I don't have an explanation for that. maybe they're just not human at all and they just eat a lot of food, because none of them seem to be struggling with it.
And maybe they need that energy to maintain whatever's holding them to this place. If I had to come up with a theory, and again, this is an Aikman story, and his stories kind of resist, they're not puzzles to be solved.
Yeah.
There was that one story we read, Four American Nights, I think it was, Three American Nights, whatever it was, that was definitely like, no, you need to reread this, because there's a progression here that...
Wasn't it Seven American
Nights? Seven American Nights, I think.
Because it wasn't based off of the... I think it was Seven American Nights, let me check.
Well, that one...
Seven American Nights, because it's based off of seven... What is it called?
Deadly Sins? I don't know. Dwarves?
Based on... I can't remember. Oh, I think the title was meant to be based on 1001 Nights.
Oh, great. Yes. Well, 7 to 1001. But like that story is definitely like there is a plot here that is obscure, but you can figure it out if you put the pieces all together. You can find the missing knight. You can shuffle it around. There's whole threads online devoted to people trying to piece together this mystery. This is a kind of story that that to me is just like, there's no, like, Aickman doesn't have an explanation. Like, there's just what happens, and you're supposed to be unnerved. And it's more about this sense of like you said, it's like, it feels like a neurodivergent person trying to navigate a very complicated social situation.
Yeah.
But if I had to choose a theory, I'm just all in on the Faye theory.
Yeah.
Because it's, to me, it I'm happy with it because that allows for things to remain ambiguous. You know, you're in a place that's hostile towards you simply because you're not part of this world.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone else seems to be doing fine. Like, no one seems to really have it in for you. But boy, oh boy, don't screw up. Or you're either going to be stuck here forever or you're going to be killed. There's rules you don't understand. You can only get out by like traversing, to break back through the barrier. Like, he goes with the hearse. Like, he has to sort of travel the road of the dead to get back to our world. Time works weird. There's a lot of like physical ambiguity of people, and especially the cat attack.
Yeah,
or whatever
that,
it was.
Yeah.
If it wasn't a cat, if it was something else, but like the bite of that animal, like, sort of worked as the doorway.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, once you eat the food, you're subject to their rule.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I like that. I mostly like it because it reminds me a lot of our old episodes.
Yeah. I think the Fae theory works really well for this, just because of how Fae stuff works in like literature and stuff.
And I find it terrifying. So
yeah, I found this story anxiety inducing because it felt too real. It felt too familiar.
Yeah.
Though again, I think that it's that whole like, I don't feel the need to be as polite as this man does.
Right.
And so I think that the beginning of this story is a pretty good like distinction between how do I phrase this? The beginning of the story is a really great example of the difference between British, like, decorum and American decorum.
Yeah.
Because there's like the whole, we live in Minnesota, there's the whole like Minnesota niceness thing. I still don't think in Minnesota there's that pressure to, like, that super intense pressure to drive the specific way somebody wants you to drive.
Right.
Like, I don't think somebody would ever be like offended unless they were just the worst.
Yeah. So if this happened in Minnesota, how would it play out?
The dude would probably get invited to a party he didn't want to go to, but like went to out of a sense of obligation. And then every time he tried to leave, would just get dragged back into a conversation of some kind and be too polite to say no.
Yeah. So there was an adaptation of this story done for television. It was directed by Dominique Othenine Girard, who was the director of Halloween 5 and The Omen 4. It was part of a series of Aickman adaptations that were done on television. They also did Hand and Glove, The Trains, and The Inner Room. And it was done in 1987, either 1987 or 1991. I find it listed both ways. It's on YouTube, and it's good. It's not the best. It relies a little bit too much on cornball music. Like, there are moments when he's talking to Bernard where the music's like, like, it tries to like make you go like, oh, isn't this weird what's happening? But it is very faithful. Like, it's pretty much the story, and it doesn't explain anything. It just lets you ride along with Maybury while he's just going through the weirdness. The actors are all really good. It's worth checking out. It's on YouTube. Anyone can check it out. It's like it's a low quality transfer, but it's good. Otherwise, there's not a whole lot of ache. I mean, we saw there was a Swords adaptation.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately existed. A very weird Swords adaptation. But I think this story works really well. I think this story would have made a very good Cabinet of Curiosities episode.
Yes, I agree. I think, though, see, I'm always like, I agree, but I think part of my issue with some of these stories being a Cabinet of Curiosities thing is the reliance on the spooky monster in Cabinet of Curiosities.
Yeah.
I think that this would not work if there was a spooky monster.
No, it'd be weird.
Yeah.
Maybe if the cat was played by some kind of fun puppet.
Yeah, but I think that would be cool.
You know what it reminds me of? In a weird way, this story reminds me of Brazil.
Yeah.
Like,
I think you said that about the last story we read.
Yeah. But it's kind of this, like, sort of nebbish everyman who's in this world of bizarre rules and customs. In Brazil, he knows the rules and customs until the end. So this is kind of like the back half of Brazil, where he's just like, things are happening around him, but he's too, like, he's too much of a British stiff upper lip to push against it too hard. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe if this was directed by Terry Gilliam into like a short episode of Cabinet of Curiosities, because it's weird and it's kind of funny in a weird like offbeat way.
It's but funny in the way that you laugh when you get nervous.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. It makes me nervously chuckle the whole time. Mm-hmm. So thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah, I liked this story. I'll give it a thumbs up.
Hooray. Ache Man. To be like the Ache Man. To live like the Ache Man.
So that's 2 for 3 for Ache Man for me, because I didn't like the swords.
Swords, yes. And like I said, the swords is growing on me.
I think I still recommended it, though.
Yeah, I think the swords is growing on me now that I get his deal. More, but doesn't matter because we're not going back to it.
No, we're going
forward
to the
D.
Ow,
we're gonna
going
get
to the. I can't. That sentence doesn't work grammatically now that I'm looking at the title of the story.
No, I was
going
gonna say
to a little something for us Tempenauts.
A little something for us Tempenauts. The final story in The Dark Descent by the Master of Horror. No, not at all.
The master of science fiction writer in English. That is one heck of a disclaimer.
That's right. Next time, we're going to be discussing A Little Something for Us Tempenauts, a short story I don't hear much about, by a man I do hear much about, Philip K. Dick, the late, great Philip K. Dick, a man of many facets who maybe didn't even exist in our universe. He is a poor, unfortunate soul who fought the system, his own mental health, his whole life, and wrote every story from a place of extreme anxiety and autobiography. So
interesting.
I think it's a weird story. That's why I said this feels like the last story, and then like it feels like A Little Something for Us Tempenauts is going to be kind of a coda on that, like a little postscript to the whole thing, because I don't think if Philip K. Dick is writing horror, and I'm curious to see. I've never read this story, so I'm curious to see where it goes. So check us out then, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that D.
Nope.
Old horse lover fat.
PKD.
PKD, baby!
He shares your first name.
He does share my first name, which means horse lover. So, we got that going for us.
Let's go.
Otherwise, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. If you're watching us, wait, hold on. It's right there. I'm pointing at our logo.
I'm not.
You can also check me out on Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast, and eventually picking up on Pizza Toast one more time. So if you like to hear my voice, do that. If you like to hear Willow's voice and you want to hear more of that, give her a call.
Don't.
Give her a call. Her phone number is 6. She'd love to hear from you.
Don't ever call me.
Don't ever call. Don't ever call me.
I won't answer, first of
all. Nope, me neither. Even if it's a call I'm waiting for.
Yeah.
I will let it go through.
If they have something important to say to me, they'll leave a voicemail.
I am currently trying to set up an interview with someone. I sent him a DM on Instagram and said, here is my phone number. Text me to let me know how, you know, what we should do next. And he called me in the middle of a performance that I was watching. I then texted him. And now we're just going back and forth, around and around, around and around. But otherwise, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for listening. We've got one more story left, and then it's on to the movies. I'm Phil.
And I'm Mario. And
I don't... I'll start over now. Hey, everybody. And we'll see you when it's Del Toro,
Del Toro time. Let's go.
You can go out of here.